Hello and welcome back to Japan Memo, the IISS Japan Chair Programme podcast. I'm Robert Ward, Japan Chair and Director of Geoeconomics and Strategy here at the IISS. Here we're joined by experts, strategists and practitioners to unpack why Japan matters in today's regional and global geopolitical landscape. Today we're very excited to welcome three wonderful guests, Professor Higashino Atsuko, Professor James Brown and Dr. Nigel Gould-Davis, to discuss Japan and Russia's war against Ukraine, which, as we all know, has just entered its third year. First, introductions. Professor Higashino Atsuko is a professor at the Institute of Humanities and Social Sciences at the University of Tsukuba in Japan. Atsuko's research focuses on international relations in Europe and the EU's relations with East Asia, especially Japan-Ukraine relations. Atsuko is also affiliated with a number of other institutions, including as a board member for the Japan Association for International Security, a study group coordinator at the Japan Association of International Relations, and as vice president of the Japan Association for Ukrainian Studies. Her recent works include, so far I think only in Japanese, a chapter in The War in Ukraine and Europe, and the chapter is called The Changes That Russia's Invasion of Ukraine Has Brought to EU Enlargement. Again, repeat, that's only in Japanese so far. Professor James Brown. James is a professor of political science at Temple University Japan campus. James's research focuses on Russia's relations with East Asia, especially Russia-Japan relations. His recent works include a chapter in an edited volume called Putin's Turn to the East in the Xi Jinping Era, and the chapter's called Russia Turns to the East Yet Away from Japan. And James has also written a chapter in Japan-Russia relations called The Troublemaker, Russian perceptions of the role of the United States in Russia-Japan relations. As well as producing academic articles, James also writes in Russian and in Japanese, so a bit of a polyglot with us today. Finally, my fellow IISS colleague, Dr. Nigel Gould-Davis. Nigel is Senior Fellow for Russia and Eurasia at the Institute. Nigel researches and writes extensively on the politics, economics and security of Russia and the former Soviet Union. Before joining the IISS, Nigel taught and conducted research on international relations in Asia. From 2010 to 2014, Nigel held senior government relations roles in the energy industry in Central and Southeast Asia. And from 2000 to 2010, he also served in what was then called the UK's Foreign and Commonwealth Office, where his roles included serving as the head of the Economics Department in Moscow and as UK ambassador to Belarus. Nigel has also written a book, and I hope you don't mind me saying you're in the middle of writing another one, but the one that is published is called Tectonic Politics, Global Political Risk in an Age of Transformation. Atsuko, James and Nigel, thank you very much for joining us. If we can start our discussion with the current status of Russia's war against Ukraine, which, as I said earlier, is now in its third year. Russia's losses in troops and materiel have been substantial. In terms of kit, the IISS estimates in its most recent military balance publication that Russia's lost over 2,900 main battle tanks since launching its war, about as many as it had in active inventory at the outset of the operation. But we also reckon that Moscow could potentially sustain around another three more years of heavy losses and then replenish tanks from stocks. Ukraine, of course, has also suffered huge losses, although Western supplies have allowed it to broadly sustain its inventory size. So we start 24 with what feels like a grim war of attrition. And then, of course, we have the Israel-Hamas war, aggravating tensions in the Middle East. And against this background, of course, Kyiv is worrying about losing international tension, with aid fatigue a particular worry for the government there. But perhaps, Nigel, to sort of start with the big picture, what are the challenges that Ukraine now faces? And the second part of this question, what does Ukraine need to do, do you think, to tip the balance in its favour?
These are difficult times for Ukraine. The scale of the Russian losses are as you described them. But on the other hand, Russia is now judged to have more forces in the field than when it launched its full-scale invasion 2 years ago. Ukraine has also suffered heavy losses. Its gross domestic product has fallen by nearly 30% or so. The moods now are different. There's an anxiety, I think, in Ukraine that is very, very different from the almost euphoric moods just over a year ago after Ukraine had made dramatic gains into Russian-occupied territory, first in Kharkiv in the north and then Kherson in the south. Ukraine is fundamentally dependent on Western support, both military and financial. So there is further anxiety when we and Ukraine look ahead to the possible course of Western politics in 2024, and in the first instance to Washington, where it's not only a matter of the possible re-election of Donald Trump in November, but even before that, we see his influence greatly complicating congressional efforts to authorize further appropriations for Ukraine. A combination of new sort of doubts and uncertainty about the future of American support, plus the failure, frankly, of Europe to take the decisions 2 years ago on stepping up its defense industrial capacity that it should have taken, mean that Ukraine is seriously undersupplied with support now. The EU has delivered only around a third of the ammunition commitments that it made. So we have this disconnect. On the one hand, still strong rhetorical support for Ukraine and a series of, most recently, bilateral security agreements being signed by European states and Ukraine. On the other hand, a failure of geoeconomics, if you like, a failure to take the necessary resource and economic measures to sustain that support in ways that are helpful to Ukraine. So Ukraine remains determined to continue to fight. There's little doubt about that, and to defeat Russia if it can. At this point, though, it's not been given the tools to finish the job, so to speak. So these are worrying and anxious times. And I'll just finish on this. There is no evidence whatsoever that I see that Russia and Putin personally have abandoned their initial primary goals of invasion, which is to say to subordinate Kiev and to install an occupational regime of some form. There is no appetite for compromise or an end to war in Russia as it steadily mobilizes more and more of its war potential.
You piqued my interest there, Nigel, with a failure of geoeconomics. Could you just flesh that out a little bit?
I would say that economics is the biggest source of Western advantage, Western superiority over this. Recall that Russia, for all of its size, amounts to so barely 2% or so of global GDP. But there are ways that the West can, and it seems to me, should be mobilizing its superiority, and it's not. One is, as I just sort of touched upon, is to turn a little more, it doesn't have to be very much, a little more of its own vastly superior GDP into weapons production to provide to Ukraine. A second way is to further increase the sanctions against Russia. Plenty have been imposed, but there's plenty that hasn't. There's a case for saying no Western company should engage legally in any transaction with Russia, because by definition, any transaction with Russia makes Russia better off. And thirdly, and finally, and most urgently, it seems to me the West has failed to take the step of confiscating the $300 billion or so of Russian central bank assets that have been frozen in Western financial systems since the start of this war. So if you put that together, that would create a lot of resources, a lot of capacity for Ukraine.
Atsuko, Nigel was talking about the possible course of Western politics. And obviously, we've already mentioned the US presidential election, which we're all looking at with great interest and trepidation. But there's also the European parliamentary elections in June, which right-wing parties are likely to do well. What do you feel will be the impact of rising Western populism on Western governments' ability to keep responding to the war against Ukraine? And do you think that what's going on in the US and in Europe politically, do you think that will have any impact on how Japan views its support for Ukraine?
I think it has got various effects on how Europeans support Ukraine to fight against this invasion. The impact of rising populism to this war is quite worrisome because inevitably most people would have taken more inward-looking view in general, trying to say that the war in Ukraine is something which is happening far away, non-EU area, so that the EU citizens should concentrate more on their own concerns, such as the rise of the cost of living or energy price, etc. Such inward-looking attitude could either directly or indirectly promote the argument that Ukraine should give up some of its territories and move on to the ceasefire even though Ukraine people do not really want to do that at all. As someone who has been looking at the politics of the European Parliament, I'm partially optimistic. When we have a look at the past course of debate in the European Parliament, large majority of the EMPs are firmly against the war and very much in favor of further sanctions vis-a-vis Russia. So I don't think that this atmosphere will be totally changed as a result of the coming European election. But still, we need to watch very carefully how this rise of populism would affect on the EU's policy towards Ukraine.
Do you see little impact on how Japan views its support for Ukraine from European US political turbulence?
Yeah, I would have to be careful about this. I don't really think that we really directly affected by the rise of populism either in Europe and the US. But at the same time, we have got the tendency that when one country or one influential person in either in US or in Europe started to say that, look, Ukraine has to abandon, then we have got an inevitable tendency to be influenced by that sort of discourse and argument. Whenever that sort of argument is appearing in the political discursive field in the US and Europe, some people might wish to jump in, even if it is in Japan. Already, in terms of ceasefire, some people are really starting to say that even European countries are trying to look for the way of swift ceasefire or immediate ceasefire. So why not? We agree with that. These very mixed arguments, partially influenced by European and US argument, which largely stems from our own argument, is an element of danger for how we discuss the support for Ukraine.
And James, coming to you, if I may, for thinking about in a bit more detail about Japan's assistance for Ukraine. In the past couple of years, it's been mostly financial. I've got some data here. According to the UNDP, Japan has been the third largest donor of financial aid to Ukraine in 2023, I think 3.7 billion worth of concessional financing and grants over the year, and a total of 4.2 billion since the start of the full-scale invasion. The reconstruction costs are likely to be absolutely huge. The World Bank's forecast about 500 billion needed over the next sort of 10 years or so for reconstruction. What's Japan's appetite for sort of pitching in a large scale way, do you think, for this reconstruction? And what do you think would have to happen on the ground for Japan to basically use taxpayers' money from the government anyway to put into Ukraine? At what point would Japan feel secure enough to start contributing more?
We've seen from the government that there is significant appetite, determination to support Ukraine, and that has been clear in the large amounts that have been pledged in terms of humanitarian and financial support for Ukraine, and also by the conference held on February the 19th, in which the Japanese government sought to arrange as much support, private sector buy-in for the rebuilding of Ukraine. The problem, of course, is that whilst rebuilding of Ukraine fits very well with Japan's approach, it fits so much better than provision of lethal weapons, which the government is not willing to do. But of course, rebuilding should primarily come after the fighting has stopped. And we're a long way from that. And so whilst the Ukrainian side is enormously welcoming of what Japan is hoping to do in that area, their real priority at the moment is not rebuilding, it's not infrastructure, it's rather ammunition.
Atsuko, you wanted to come in, and I saw Nigel nodding as well. First you, Atsuko, then Nigel did come in.
In Japan, James is absolutely right. We have got plenty of reasons to support Ukraine in terms of reconstruction. But at the same time, I'm a little bit concerned about the discourse of aid fatigue in Japan, which is, again, quite evident. But I can disagree with that argument, saying that we are only spending 0.17% of our whole GDP in order to support Ukraine, whereas the country like Estonia, they are spending 3.6%. We are not actually in the position to be tired of the whole support for Ukraine. So I really would like to make that data strongly in favor of supporting Ukraine even more. Some people are quite reluctant, referring to, for example, the Noto earthquakes or higher energy expenditure allegedly caused by the sanctions, etc., and other reasons to stop supporting Ukraine. But what I keep talking to Japanese people is that supporting Ukraine or supporting any country that is a victim of aggression is essentially extremely important for Japan itself, because Japan is a country that has benefited largely from international law and order. It should be unacceptable, or it should be simply wrong, to say that we are beneficiary of that system and that we don't really care about the other countries. So I think it is really important for the Japanese people to take the Ukrainian case as if our own law and security are in danger. I'm in a position to repeatedly talking to Japanese people about the necessity of supporting Ukraine.
As Prime Minister Kishida said, sort of in his sort of iconic comment, Ukraine today could be East Asia tomorrow. So that sort of backs up what you're saying, Atsuko. Nigel, you were nodding when James was talking there. Would you want to come in?
Absolutely. No, I fully agree with what James said. It's easier and perhaps therefore more tempting for other countries, not only Japan, I see this tendency in Europe as well, to think and plan and talk about a happy future, post-war future, whose primary task will be assisting Ukraine's reconstruction, than to attend to the immediate and urgent task of supporting Ukraine in its war and thereby creating the conditions that will make reconstruction possible. And there is an Asian dimension to this as well, I think. North Korea has provided over 1 million artillery shells to Russia to help it fight the war, much needed by Russia. I imagine that's something that Japan has noticed and drawn conclusions from as well.
And James, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I was just going to add that whilst I personally would like to see Japan actually provide weaponry to Ukraine, but that's not really on the table at the moment. But what I think is important to raise is that there's actually a lot more that I think Japan can do in the area of military equipment without crossing that threshold and actually providing weapons. So Japan has promised some old self-defense force vehicles, but they've been rather slow in being refitted and actually being provided to Ukraine. Also, I know the Ukrainian side is very interested in some anti-drone technology that Japan has. And so far, the Japanese side has been hesitant about providing that. So I think even before we get onto the idea of Japan really changing its stance and possibly providing weaponry, there's a lot more that they can do in non-lethal military technology.
Thank you, James. Your point, Nigel, you reminded us about North Korea's role in this conflict. And if one had said 5 years ago that North Korea would be providing Russia with ammunition for its war in Europe, you would have been laughed out of the room. But it just shows just how geopolitics have changed. We talked about the reconstruction conference that's just happened in Tokyo. What were the key takeaways from that conference? Atsuko, perhaps you go first.
Yes, it is emphasized that Japan can do its own way of support in order to get the reconstruction going. James is absolutely correct that the actual start of the serious reconstruction will be after the end of the war. But at the same time, I think there's also a broad consensus among the countries that support Ukraine that reconstruction processes need to be started right away, not after the end of this war. It is very important to note that Japan convened Japan-Ukraine Conference for Promotion of Economic Growth and Reconstruction in Tokyo a few weeks ago. Many Japanese enterprises, who actually used to be a little bit reluctant to make any investment in Eastern Europe, are now actively trying to join the reconstruction businesses in war-torn Ukraine. Quite a few Japanese enterprises voices that they would like to be active in reconstructing the bridges, highways, roads, or power stations, etc. Many ideas were gathered at this conference, so I think it sends a very important signal to Ukraine about our very supportive intentions. But at the same time, there are many questions and so many obstacles, of course, for Japan in order to join this reconstruction plan. The first thing is that it is now very, very difficult for Japanese businesses to go to Ukraine in the first place because there are a lot of governmental restrictions and limitations to go to any of the war-torn area in the world, which is, of course, understandable. But if we compare the situation with South Korea, it is rapidly reducing restrictions for its own enterprises to go to Ukraine for the sake of reconstruction. So South Korea is moving much quicker and much further than Japan in this regard. So in legal way or business-wise, there's so many things that Japan can do in order to support the reconstruction in Ukraine more efficiently.
And James, what were your takeaways?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it was a very good start. I mean, you had around 80 firms involved, various agreements signed, but it is only a starting point. And it will be interesting to see to what extent Japanese firms feel that they can really operate in Ukraine. So the Ministry of Foreign Affairs here in Japan has altered or is moving to alter its travel advice. Instead of a blanket advice on you must not visit Ukraine, making some exceptions, but still providing really quite strict conditions, saying that, you know, you have to have security personnel, you need to have bulletproof vehicles, that sort of thing. So I think what's really going to be key for Japanese firms thinking about operating there is really having partner companies, of course, partner companies within Ukraine, but actually partner companies from states like Poland, like Czech Republic, who perhaps have more local expertise and also more of a willingness to have personnel present within Ukraine.
Thinking about Japanese firms in Ukraine, and I suppose the whole reconstruction conversation as well, that does bring us to the issue of corruption. Everyone would agree that's been a long-standing issue for Ukraine. A question to Nigel. You and I have talked at the IISS about how Ukraine has been trying to tackle its corruption issue. Perhaps could you say a few words on that for us, please?
The issue needs to be acknowledged, and it is in Ukraine. There has been more progress in tackling corruption in Ukraine since 2014, since the so-called Revolution of Dignity, than cumulatively in the years after Ukraine's independence leading up to that. So there's been a step change since then. The direction of travel has been the right one. Secondly, in really corrupt countries, leaders, especially presidents, find ways to win elections. They never lose because they can corruptly manage and control elections. In Ukraine, the incumbent essentially always loses when there's an election. Most recently in 2019, when Pyotr Poroshenko lost emphatically to essentially a political unknown, Volodymyr Zelensky, who won something like 78% of the vote. So I think that should be a measure of the limits of corruption, that power is defeated by democracy when it really happens. And the third point is that corruption, again, of course, remains a problem. It is something that civil society is acutely attuned to, especially to the extent that corruption can hinder wartime efforts at procurement in particular. And Zelensky has changed out parts of his leadership team, most recently at the Ministry of Defense, to try to tackle this. So yes, it exists, but we need to keep it in perspective. It's in no sense a severe or uncontrollable problem, and all the attempts to tackle it have been and continue to move in the right direction.
Hatsuko, I can see you nodding there. Perhaps I'll bring you in then in your response to what Nigel said, but also, does Japan have any kind of leverage in terms of how to help Ukraine address its governance issues?
If I may start with your last question, Japan has been actively involved for the improvement of the corruption issues in Ukraine. For example, in the framework of G7 ambassador meetings. It is a meeting by the G7 countries, including, of course, Japan, occasionally meets the high-level officials in Ukraine, including the president or the president team, in order to advise what should be done or if there's any new element to bring in, etc. So I understand that G7 countries, including Japan, has been very active in this issue, and it has been evident, obvious improvement in this issue. I totally agree with Nigel about what he has said. And if I may add just one thing, it is very significant that Ukraine started the accession negotiation with the EU, because any country has to deal with the corruption issue as a condition to be a member country of the EU. Ukraine has got the unprecedented workload that they have to continue fighting with Russia, but at the same time, they have to go through the very cumbersome, very difficult, very energy-consuming EU enlargement processes. But the reform itself would obviously help Ukraine to be a stronger and stable and corruption-free country. This is what we really expect the EU to support Ukraine, and this is what I expect my own government to support the whole process in multiple ways in order to solve the issue of corruption in Ukraine.
James, coming back to your point about Japanese firms in Ukraine, you've been looking at Japanese-Russia relations for a long time. A lot of Japanese firms are also operating in Russia. Is this going to be difficult for them to straddle both Russia and Ukraine? And do you think that if Japanese firms start operating in Ukraine in greater numbers, that there's a risk of sort of retaliatory coercion to operations in Russia?
Well, perhaps there is, but I'm afraid they don't get too much pity from me, because in my view, I think that most firms, except for a few cases, should have withdrawn. If we look at the data, however, at the start of the conflict, there were 168 Japanese firms which were recorded as having a presence within Russia, and actually only 20.8% of those have withdrawn. Now, a further 26.8% have frozen their activities, but that still leaves an awful lot of companies who are still operating there. Now, the energy thing is a different subject. I mean, that's more debatable as to whether they should be there. But for other firms, at the very least, they should have stopped their operations, because if you continue operating, generating revenue, you are paying tax to the Russian state. You are indirectly supporting the war effort. Now, overall, I'm very supportive of Japan's government's position, but as with most countries, there are some areas where questions can be raised, and the one here is actually to do with Japan Tobacco, a company which is partly owned by the Japanese state, and it is continuing to operate within Russia, to the extent that the Ukrainian government has actually listed this as an international sponsor of the war. For those firms and others, I think they should be withdrawing.
You mentioned Sakhalin 2. Clearly, Japan's energy vulnerabilities are quite significant. So this is presumably why there's been a bit of a carve out for this operation to continue. What do you think the outlook is for Sakhalin 2, I suppose, on the one hand? And in your sense, is Japan sort of actively looking to try to replace the gas LNG that comes in from Sakhalin 2 to sort of reduce dependency there?
Not really. The Japanese side is looking around for other options when it comes to liquefied natural gas, holding some talks in the Middle East to see if some additional supplies are available there. But what is very striking is that there is no plan from the Japanese government to reduce its dependence on Russian LNG. So I think that whilst you can make the case that in the short term, yes, we understand Japan is an energy insecure nation, they need to continue importing that 9 to 10% of their LNG that they get from Russia. Well, it's now been 2 years. If they had been more active, they could have reduced that percentage, perhaps by more actively seeking out other LNG or bringing on other energy forms. But what concerns me is that there seems to be no plan to actually reduce or replace these energy imports from Russia. And a final point on that is that whilst that's always framed as supporting Japan's energy security, you can really flip that argument. In my view, there's a real energy insecurity for Japan on that, because we have seen time and time again that Russia is willing to use its energy exports as a foreign policy instrument.
Atsuko and Nigel, you both wanted to come in.
James is absolutely right. And we have to admit that the diversification of Japan's energy policy has been very, very slow for the past 2 years. And it is highly likely that it continues to be so for the near future, as finding alternative energy supplier has been very, very difficult. So that is one of the very difficult dimension of our Russian policy, because they are sanctioning Russia while depending on Russian energy. It's becoming to be one of the realities of the way that Japan stand up against the aggression of Russia. I think it is really important now from the policies so far of the European countries. For example, Czech and other Central European countries are still dependent on Russian energy, but still very active in supporting Ukraine and sanctioning Russia in other way. I think it is being forced to dependence on Russian energy and being supportive to Ukraine doesn't necessarily contradict with each other. We have to live with that sort of reality that we cannot really change the way that we proceed with diversification in one day or the other. But at the same time, we have to support Ukraine in other way and sanction Russia in other way.
Perhaps so we can come back to what these other ways may be in a second. Nigel, you wanted to come in.
Atsuko and James both make very interesting points. Atsuko observed there is a small number of European countries that are still dependent on importing Russian gas. That is fixed pipeline gas, and it's very difficult in the short term, given the incomplete connectivity infrastructure within Europe, to find alternative supplies. It's harder for me to understand, though, why Japan is not actively looking for alternative suppliers of LNG, which in every sense is a much more flexible and liquid market. In particular, in light of the fact that over the next 2 years, a very significant number of new LNG projects are coming online and will be starting to export to global markets. By some estimates, the total available supply of LNG globally will rise by something like 45%, consequence in particular of major new projects in America and the Middle East as well. It follows from that, there should in principle be many more opportunities for all buyers of LNG, including Japan and other supply options. So I'm really struck by James's point that despite these predictable sort of market trends, Japan does not seem to be looking ahead to take advantage of that.
James.
Were it not for US Treasury sanctions, Japan would be on course to actually increase its percentage of imports from Russia when it comes to LNG. And that's because of another project the Japanese consortium has a stake in. That's the Arctic LNG 2 project, where JOGMEC, the Japanese government-backed institution, along with Mitsui, have a 10% stake. And this project is now coming into production, and it did look like Japan was on course to begin importing LNG from this project, which would be much more controversial. It's one thing to continue your imports from an existing project. It's quite another to support new Russian gas exports. That, however, all got put on hold because the US Treasury then sanctioned Arctic LNG 2, meaning that whilst the Japanese consortium still holds their 10% stake in that project, they're unable to take imports from there.
Let's move now to Russia's military presence near Japan. Its war against Ukraine has reduced its conventional military forces, and there's concerns, I think, about build-up of nuclear capability, particularly around the Sea of Okhotsk. That's on the one side. Japan's relations with Russia are clearly chilled at the moment for obvious reasons. Japan pushed for Prime Minister Abe Shinzo in 2012-2020 for the return of its northern territories, which the then Soviet Union seized at the end of World War II. Moscow's also increased its military presence around the Kuril Islands, as evidenced by the Vostok 2022 naval exercise. How do you see this Sino-Russia strategic relationship within the context of all the stuff we've been talking about? And how do you think Japan should respond to what Russia's doing in its immediate neighbourhood, starting with Nigel?
The Sino-Russian relationship is probably now at its strongest and warmest since at least the very beginning of the 1950s, possibly ever, which doesn't mean to say there aren't problems and tensions and ambiguities about it. But on the security side, there is clearly, in respect of China's growing supply of not yet military, but militarily usable and useful components and supplies, in respect also of the joint exercises in many theatres that the two countries have been conducting, and some other respects too. This is strong. There's also cooperation in matters of domestic surveillance and control. Economically, I think, despite all the warm words about an eternal friendship without limits, quietly under the surface, we see China actually pushing some quite hard bargains. And this underlying sense that the balance of advantages in the relationship is moving steadily in China's favor in ways that discomfort some more thoughtful commentators in Russia. Russia's war in Ukraine has had an enormous impact on the relationship too. And I think we've seen a journey on the part of China, initially very disconcerted by the invasion, in particular by Russia's failure to win it quickly. China's public anxieties about the potential Russian use of nuclear weapons in that war. But since early last year, I think we've seen the two countries come closer, marked especially by Xi Jinping's state visit to Moscow in March 2023, of course. But China still cross-pressured. Russia needs China more than the other way around. If there's a question of which party can be more flexible and potentially more biddable in some respect, then I think it's China we have to look to rather than Russia, whose fundamentally adversarial posture towards the West and its partners is likely to remain for the foreseeable future.
James.
You're absolutely right that Russia has been increasing its military presence and military activities to the north of Japan. But at the same time, if you look at the capabilities that it's been putting there, it's mainly anti-ship missiles, it's anti-aircraft systems. And so I think what they're really doing there is cementing their control over the Sea of Ochotsk, which is so important for Russian submarines operating out of Kamchatka. So actually, from Japan's point of view, that's not such a worry, because it's clear that that is for a specific strategic reason. It's not a preparation for an attack on Japan. So from Japan's point of view, whilst Russia certainly is a major concern, it's not a direct military threat. So instead, I think the real worry for Japan is what Nigel was just talking about, which is the cooperation between Russia and China, those joint aviation patrols by their strategic bombers, which began in 2019, the circuits of the Japanese archipelago, which has been carried out by flotillas of Chinese and Russian vessels. That's the real worry, that Russia is serving as an accomplice to China. And the question of what Russia could possibly do during a Taiwan contingency is one which is quite worrying. I don't think contributing directly, but there is the worry that Russia could perhaps engage in diversionary activities, coordinating its behavior with China. And then added to that, of course, Russia can also play that accomplice role, that emboldening role for North Korea as well. So I think that's where Japan's real concerns come in.
Atsuko, Russia is an accomplice for China and North Korea. Over to you.
I agree with James that the likelihood that Russia can conduct two-front war at this very moment is low. But the risk will obviously be greater if Russia wins this war in the future and restore its military force spending few years from now. That would obviously be quite serious for us as well. What we Japanese need to do right now, right away, is to get rid of the naive illusion that we have had so many years that Russia is a negotiable partner, trustworthy partner who keeps its promises, etc. We Japanese have been believing in this sort of discourse for such a long time, and now we need to elaborate several scenarios to face Russia's threat in several different ways. In terms of Russia-China relationship, I don't really think that China and Russia are a natural partner. As long as they can challenge the US-led, US-centered world order, they collaborate with each other. At this very moment, it seems that China and Russia are sharing such goals, but I don't think that this is a very strong or permanent sort of relationship or partnership. However, We have to admit that Russia's Sino approximation is in itself very, very dangerous and challenging. In this regard, we Japanese have to really bear in mind that we are actually helping Russian sanction evasion by our trade with China, contrary to a policy that stands against Russian invasion. Several weeks ago, we had a huge media coverage that the Japan's export to China is used to evade sanctions vis-a-vis Russia, that sanctioned strategic products that is exported to China from Japan is re-exported to Russia, which obviously nullify the effect of sanction. So we have to admit that the reality that we are in one way or the other contributing to the continuation of the war which Russia is conducting. But at the same time, it is really difficult for us to cut everything in terms of the Japan-China trade, of course. This is something that we really need to elaborate further, how to stop contributing, adding up to Russia's capability to continue the war.
The issue with trade with China, I think it's not just a Japan issue. I think we're so interdependent with China that cutting things off sometimes is a bit more difficult than it might seem. So that brings us to the end of the subject questions and to our Japan memo questions. We have two questions that we ask all our guests, all is the same question, and we just get fabulous answers. So much looking forward to your answers. And the two questions are, do you have a book or books recommendation for listeners who wish to understand? And you are allowed to recommend your own books, recommend as you wish. And the second question is, what do you think people often get wrong about Japan? Let's start with James for those two questions, and then go to Nigel and then to Atsuko to have the last word.
I'm very tempted to recommend my own new book, but it's not available as yet. It hopefully will be coming out later this year. It's a history of Russian espionage against Japan, perhaps one to look out for. It's called Cracking the Crab, Russian Espionage Against Japan. And the cracking the crab thing refers to a Richard Sorge quote. So that's why it's got that title. The book that I'm recommending is Sherzod Muminov, published in 2022, and it's 11 Winters of Discontent. So I wanted to select something to do with Japan-Russia relations. And this is about the 600,000 Japanese who were deported to Siberia and other areas at the end of the Second World War, the difficult conditions that they went through in labor camps, the indoctrination that they went through, and also their lives when they returned to Japan, some of them as late as 1956.
And the second question, what do you think, James, people get wrong about Japan?
It's sometimes thought that there is still a state of war between Japan and Russia. And I think that it's an understandable mistake because people know that there's no peace treaty between the two sides. And so they assume, there must be a state of war. That's not the case. In 1956, they signed a joint declaration which put an end to the state of war. So yes, relations are very bad. There's no peace treaty, but there is not a state of war.
Excellent. Thank you, James. Nigel, over to you.
I'm the non-Japanese specialist here, so I'm poorly qualified. So if I may offer a different cultural product, the film Rashomon, which of course is a cinematic classic. I remember when I first watched it was a profound experience and encourages one to kind of explore and meditate on themes like the unreliability of narrative, the fragility and contingency of truth, the elusiveness of truth. It repays regular watching, I think, in terms of its essence, but also its influence on the subsequent evolution of cinema. I think it's just unequaled, I would say.
That's the great Kurosawa Rashomon you're talking about.
Yes. Are there any others?
Well, there may be. I haven't heard of them, but yes, good point.
That's the one I had exactly right, the Kurosawa. Which I understand was an unexpected classic. He did not particularly expect it to acquire the status, but its genius was appreciated in due course. Things that we get wrong about Japan. Well, again, I'm less qualified than my colleagues here, but I will just offer a thought about an intriguing fact from my sort of study of international history, and it's relevant to Britain and to Russia as well. It's the fact that Britain, at the very beginning of the 20th century, began to depart from its proud tradition of so-called splendid isolation by first agreeing a treaty with Japan in 1902. This was in large measure to try to avert and prevent Russian expansionism in the Far East. So it was a turning point in British foreign policy, a turning point in its policy towards both Japan and Russia. It may have had a similar significance for Japan as well, especially in light of the war between Russia and Japan that followed soon after. But I leave it to my colleagues to provide the Japan part of that story.
Thank you. Interesting historic perspective there. Atsuko, you have the final words.
Since I was told that it doesn't really have to be a book published in English language, I would like to introduce one of the volumes that I contributed as well. It is the Kokusai Anzen Hoshou ga Wakaru Guidebook, meaning a guidebook in order to understand international security, brought together by Akagi Kanji, a very famous Japanese expert in international security, and it is also compiled by International Association of the Security Studies in Japan. This is a very interesting particular book. 123 books concerning international security, spanning from the history book, spanning from the strategy book, and regional study book, etc., which has something to do with international security or regional history, is introduced by more than 100 experts in Japan, and it's all written in Japanese, or it is a translation of the books into Japanese. It is interesting in a way that the students of international security can pick up the very good books, either from classical, from the very contemporary book, but at the same time, how the Japanese experts have been reading the books of international security, how they interpreted that, and how they tried to introduce the advantages of such books to other people. So that is very, very interesting in many ways. I myself introduced a book written by Mark Mazwa, A Dark Continent. It is normally taken as the European history book, but if you read it as the history of European security, that would add another set of interpretation to this book. So I would wholeheartedly recommend this book to you. And in terms of your second question about the misunderstandings about Japan, well, I often pleasantly surprised to see that how many people all over the world understand Japan very, very correctly. So I don't really feel so many occasions that Japan is misunderstood. But at the same time, if I may add a very, very personal, smallish thing, many people may consider that people in Japan read solely Japanese manga and anime. And I'm not that sort of person, actually. So whenever I take my kids to school, many kids run in front of me trying to talk about Naruto or Dragon Ball, Kimetsu no Yaiba, etc. But I'm not a person really adequate to speak anything about this manga or anime. So I think I should take a look. However, I'm too busy to do my own research. So I keep disappointing very important people about this aspect. This is a very tiny misunderstanding about any Japanese very knowledgeable about manga, anime in Japan.
Yes, I myself am not that knowledgeable about manga either. So it's a whole sort of universe waiting to be explored by us all. Thank you so much, Atsuko, James and Nigel, for a wonderful session. Really covered so much ground. And thank you so much for your expertise and viewpoints. And thank you to our listeners as well for joining us on another episode of Japan Memo. If you have any comments or feedback, please contact us on JapanChair, all one word, at IISS.org. If you enjoyed this episode, we urge you to subscribe to Japan Memo on the podcast platform of your choice. And for more insightful analysis, I also encourage you to look at past research by the Japan Chair Program and by the IISS more broadly on our website. We also hope to connect with you on Twitter, or X as it is now called, of course, where we're actively sharing the latest news and analysis on everything Japanese geopolitics and more. You can find me at Robert Allen Ward. You can find Atsuko at Atsuko Higashi, all one word, and you can find James at James DJ Brown, and you can find Nigel at Nigel GD1, all one word. Thanks very much again, and see you next time. Goodbye.